Okay, good evening. Welcome to this, the FIT seminar in the British Government's Fidelity Research Seminar Series, designed to promote and showcase cutting-edge work by LSE academics. This week we are, this month, lucky to have Professor Patrick Dunleavy from the LSE Government Department, who is going to talk about reappraising political power. He will then take over the chairing and managing of it till the end. Patrick.
Okay, thanks. I'll just key off on my slides, if you don't mind. Okay, I'd like to do three things, really, in this talk. The first is to just introduce the concept of power, explain why it's been an age-old problem, and how, with great genius, I managed to solve it. So that's the sort of first bit of the talk. There's a typical academic kind of claim, and you need to come back at me and contest it if you disagree. And then I'm going to give you like two little stories or applications where it would be I'll try and explain some of what I've done or what I'm suggesting. And one of these has got numbers in about the British general election of 2010. So I hope it will be of some interest. And the other one is a story, a qualitative case, a story which is a particular dramatic and condensed and very hard to grip in some ways, story of a struggle for power aboard one of the aircraft that was hijacked on 9/11. So let me just black that out a bit and say a thing about power. If you look at an average political science bookshop, you'll see a lot of books about power. Noam Chomsky's just bringing out a new book called The System of Power. And I can guarantee that if you look inside 99.9% of these books to see if there's a definition of what power means in the index, you won't find it. And typically, people sort of use it as a thing that sort of sells books, but then we're very unclear about what power is. But this all dates back to, well, the person who's most fascinated by it perhaps was Thomas Hobbes, who, writing just after the Civil War, the English Civil War between the King and the Parliament, said, "In the first place amongst human motivations, I put for a general inclination of all mankind a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceaseth only in death. And the cause of this is not always that a man hopes for more..." Sorry, it's very sexist because of the period. "A man hopes for a more intensive delight than he has already attained to, or that he cannot be content with a moderate power, but because he cannot assure the power and the means to live well which he hath presently without the acquisition of more." So the idea is you have to get into this restless and ceaseless search for power because everybody else is doing it, and if you don't do it, then you won't be able to hang on even to the things that you already have. And then when he started to try and describe what power means, he quickly starts just listing resources. So having a title is power, having wealth is power, having lots of followers is power, having lots of friends is power, being the kind of person who makes friends is power, being smart is power, and so on. So sorts of a list of resources, but it doesn't really get to the heart of what we think. And later people have sort of hinted that power is a very quantitative thing. Bertrand Russell said, "Power may be defined as the production of intended effects. It's thus a quantitative concept." And then he, in the rest of his book on power, he went waffling on about it, telling lots of stories about this power and that power and the other, and never quantified anything. C. Wright Mills wrote, "Power refers to the realizations of one's will, even if others resist. This is what we call the standard they bear in account of power. Like status, he said, this has not been well indexed. And then he again told lots of stories about power, but never really quantified it. But I think this is a shame and a pity, and I really want the solution I'm suggesting to you is something in the way of how we might quantify it. But firstly, you might just think about why we haven't quantified it already. And the answer is that we've had these radically different concepts of power. And there are three really big ones. The one that started off with Hobbes is that power is based on resources. And so the more resources you have, the more power you have. And in the modern period, all Marxist theory tends to argue this quite strongly until we get to the sort of post-Marxist. And most elite theory argues that about. So really what we need to do is we just need to tot up your wealth, your control of other people, your institutional position, things like that, and we will get a direct measure of your power. Whereas most liberal purists have adhered to this position here, which says that you can only measure power in a conflict of interest. So I only have power over you to the extent I can get you to do something that you don't want to do or which you wouldn't do otherwise. If I can, in that sense, if I can induce you to do what I want, if I can get my way against resistance, then that's the absolute kernel of what power is about. And opposed to that, there have been a lot of sociologists, conservative sociologists, particularly Talcott Parsons and a German social theorist who's not as well known called Nicholas Luhmann, but who is a very brilliant social theorist now, sadly dead. And they both emphasize that power is, you know, it's not something that you have over people, it's something that you have with people. Power is about your ability to realize some collective outcome or some collective goal. And in the middle, we have a very specialist political science literature called, those of you who are in there know, the Power Index literature. And this particularly focuses on your ability to form a winning coalition. So it's sort of partly about power over other possible coalitions, but it's also partly about your ability to coalesce with others so as to be effective. And the measures of power that this particular sub-literature has produced are interesting, but they have not been widely accepted by political scientists in general, and they're not generally used. And I'll show you a few cases of why that is. So the question is, how can we sort of pull all this together and get to something like a quantitative concept, or a concept that could in certain circumstances be quantitative? And here's my solution. So I'm giving you the story right at the start. You can leave after this because everything else is just illustration. Okay, so the solution is somebody's political power, an actor or a block of actors, is a function of, it's mathematically defined by, if we were looking at a formula, we'll see it in a formula one, the weighted sum of their resources and their coalitional potential. And resources could be the sorts of things that we've already mentioned, Hobbes, Linked, described, and coalitional potential, I'll explain a bit more, is what the power index literature mentions. Plus, their exogenous luck, and by that we mean that sometimes things happen somewhere else, which you haven't brought about, but may enhance or reduce your power. You may have a whole stock of resources, you may be all set up with a nice coalition, something happens somewhere else that increases or lowers your power. And finally, we've got an additional error term, because we're never going to get it exactly right, and there's always going to be lots of things that we haven't captured. Power is a very relational complex concept. Now that's the verbal formulation. This is the formulation as an equation. some of you will like equations, some of you will hate them, but so basically this equation looks very complicated, but whenever you see a J, that just means whoever we're talking about. J is just the person. P stands for power, R stands for resources, C stands for your coalitional potential, your ability to form a winning coalition with other people, L stands for your luck, and this one is the average. So the focus of most of what I'm saying is this weighting of resources and coalitional potential. So what I'm claiming is that whoever you are, whatever your situation, whatever the nature of the power relationship, the two key things will be your resources and your ability to coalesce with other people, but they'll be weighted. And obviously the weighting is very, very important, because U plus 1 minus U sum to 1. And the question is, so what is the value of U? And the answer is, I haven't the least idea. So it's a great equation if only we knew what U was. But I don't know what U is. But I do think we can fill in U in a plausible way. We can decide what the value might be, what weight we're going to give to resources, what weight we're going to give to coalition potential in different settings. So that's a sort of slightly mathematical looking formula, if only I could operationalize any of these things, which I can't. But let's just start with the what does resources mean? And a good thing here is always when you, you know, have a new concept, is try and list some resources. And I've listed them using a typology that some of you will know from Chris Hood, called the NATO typology, toe with an E on the end. And basically it says governments have five key resources: nodality, authority, treasure, organization, and expertise. It's just a typology. It's just, we could cut it lots of different ways, but this is a good way of organizing it. So here are some kind of things that count as resources in power relationships. So we start with nodality, and the most important resource here is information. Very, very often in power relationships, if you have information, you're powerful. If you don't have information, you're not powerful. We'll see a very good example of this in the United 93 case later on. But there are other things that that might make you a nodal person, somebody that people want to talk to, somebody people want to communicate with, somebody people want to do what you ask them to do just because you're who you are. There could be all kinds of things that make you nodal. Secondly, authority is very important. So we're normally dealing with power relationships in an institutional or organized context. Institutions and organizations parcel up power, give it to people to hold for certain amounts of time, give them legitimacy from holding that power for that amount of time. So authority is very important to most of the power relationships we're interested in. Sometimes, for example, we have parties, we give them a certain electorate, decides how many MPs they'll have. That's a key resource for all future decisions. And in a legislature, we have a very fixed and defined winning post. You've got to get 50% plus one of the MPs to vote for your legislation or pass new legislation. But there's also positions of authority that allow you to issue orders, that give you legal force, and give you institutional power, and so on. And then, of course, there's treasure, which is not just money, but wealth and property and the ability to command or requisition other resources. Very important, particularly in elite theory and Marxist accounts. Pluralist accounts generally tend to poo-poo this and say, oh no, it all depends on your political setting. But on the whole, I think wealth and power are very, very closely related in many settings. And then the other two things are organization, really the ability to get your act together and to get on with people, and expertise. So particularly in modern day political processes, if you have expertise at your disposal, you're going to usually be more influential than not. So that's the first thing that sort of fills out the equation a bit. We can get a pretty good handle on what counts as resources. And then the The more difficult thing to explain is coalitional potential. I'm going to give a deliberately very, very simple case, but believe you me, we can get fiendishly more complicated if anybody wants to. So don't say to me this is pretty blinking simple, because there's lots more that we could do. So let's just take a case where we have three voters and they are operating in a legislature with 100 people and you need 51% to win. Okay? And the resources that they have, their particular kind of resource in the legislature, is votes. So the three parties, or three blocks, one has 49%, one has 48%, the other has 3%. So none of them can reach 51% on their own. What's the coalitional potential of those blocks? Now, according to the theory that I'm looking at, power indices, the answer is given at the bottom. Namely, they each have a third of the coalitional potential. So how can that be? We look at A and B, they're very big, they're very close together. C is nowhere, but A could form a coalition with C, or A could form a coalition with B. B could form a coalition with A or with C. So what we've done is we've really looked at all the possible winning combinations, and then every time, so there's really four of them, A, B, A, C, or B, C, and then A, B, C. And then we've said, well, how many times is that actor crucial? And if the actor's crucial, we've got it in red. We count it up. They're each crucial 2 out of 4 times. They each have what's called a raw Banzhaf score of 50%. Trouble with that is 3 actors with 50% adds to 150%. We don't like that. So we normalize it to reduce it to 100%. And then the score that we end up with is a third of the power goes to each of the actors, despite this huge gap between A and B on the one hand and C on the other. In other words, the coalitional potential you have is defined by your resources and the threshold that you need to get, but it's not the same. It can be very, very different. Everybody following me on this one? Because this is the point to shout out, otherwise it gets more, a little bit more complicated. So that's why I've got resources in there and coalitional potential. They are related. The coalitional potential depends on how many resources you've got in relation to how many resources everybody else has got. But it's not. It can diverge quite radically.
Just to be sure, I mean, I get the mathematics bit, but just to be sure, this is measuring, as it were, the crude, no, I don't mean crude in a bad way, but the crude potential to form a coalition. Nothing about the dynamics of it, simply the potential to do it.
Exactly. I mean, we don't know in this thing whether A hates C or B hates C.
All of that's left out.
We don't know anything about
crude
that.
Potential.
It's a very, very substructure of the situation. Exactly.
I'm with you.
Okay. Well, now the question is, how different is it? And what happens if we take a weighted average of the thing? And so what I've done here is I've just put three actors. These are their resource shares. This is their coalitional potential. And let's just assume that I've suddenly got insight as to what U is, and U is just a half, so that power and resources and coalitional potential are weighted the same. Let's just assume I've solved it. It's just because we need to sit there. And then we can think, well, how much does my power ranking differ from, let's say, this ranking, or the Marx's ranking, say, or the coalitional potential? Well, when everybody's on more or less the same resources, there's not much difference. Okay? They're virtually identical. But if we go to this 49.474, in coalitional potential terms, they're all equal. But now we're taking a weighted average of coalitional potential and we're weighting it equally. We've got something in between these two results. So we're saying that the third actor, the very small player, actually is very, very much more powerful than you might think, but nothing like as powerful as this coalitional potential.
power in excess.
And essentially what this does is it copes with many of the problems of previous power indices by giving you a more realistic looking picture of small players. Small players can be pivotal, they can be, you know, very important in certain situations, but they're not as important as the coalitional potential measure suggests. And the other situation where we could think about is supposing somebody's won, supposing somebody's already over the threshold. Okay? Threshold is 51%, somebody's got 52%. In the coalitional potential thing, they've got all the power already, so everybody else has got 0. And the question is that actually very plausible? If somebody has won the general election, but they've only got a tiny majority, have they got all the power? Well, if they've got, like, you know, 5/6 of the power, we might be happier saying it's 100-0. But in this situation, I think we'd be very unhappy about saying it's 100-0. And again, if we take my solution, we can get to some median score. It's actually, sadly, the same score in every situation. But the same process in every situation. But it produces a graduated response. So we can see that winning a little bit gets you a lot of power, but then winning more gets you a little bit more power. So there's some realistic progression. Okay, well, I'm going to skip the next slide, which is just the same thing, and try and apply this to the UK general election. And this is what happened in the UK general election in terms of in 2010.
There are a lot of smaller parties here, but let's just focus attention. We have to take all of those into account to measure power. But let's just focus on the big three. So the Conservatives didn't get enough to get to 51%, they're at 47.6. Labour's got a lot of MPs despite falling in votes, they're still in there, and the Liberal Democrats, although they had a lot of votes, 23%, they only got 9% of the MPs. So if we then say, well, how much power, how much coalitional potential do they have? These are the rankings, and so pretty lower than the share of MPs for the Conservatives, higher than the share of MPs for the Liberal Democrats, because the Conservatives couldn't form a majority government without them. Actually, that was the only really easy to form majority government. You couldn't have more complicated ones involving Labour. It wouldn't really have worked. But the coalitional potential said the Labour Party with 5 times as many MPs as the Liberal Democrats, nonetheless has the same score. That's quite, you know,
if you want to use a coalition potential and call it a power index, that's really very implausible.
So what would my solution do? Well, supposing we just imagine that we knew what U was and we could fix this value again, and we weighted them equally, we'd come up with a ranking like this. And I suggest to you that this ranking is a much better kind of picture of what we intuitively think of. If you don't agree, then you have an argument about it, but I couldn't really prove it to you. So it leaves Labour, you know, more significant than the Liberal Democrats, but not as significant as the Conservatives, because it was very difficult for Labour to get to a majority government with any other partner, except a very complex set.
Then what happens when the government forms and the Conservative and Liberal Democrats get together?
Well, then they have more than 51%. If we're following the kind of old power index literature, we say they have all the power, and Labour, although it has 40% of MPs, would be ranked as having no power. Well, of course, it's not in a very powerful position, but it's not got no power. And it's not got no power because resources are a condensation of what's happened in the past, and they also allow you to project to what might happen in the future. So
Labour has a very long history of being one of the top two parties. It's been in government before, it was in government until 2010, could be in government again. We need to have some measure of its power that sort of recognises that. And that's what my measure will say. So it says, collectively the coalition's got 78% of the power, if we're assuming that it's a half and half there. Now you could argue with that, but it wouldn't make much difference to that number. And Labour's got like a fifth.
What sort of time frame do you look at with this in terms of the ability to, I mean, possibly I'm completely misunderstanding, the potential to get to power tomorrow, next week, or in 5 years' time?
Right.
How does that affect?
Well, look, immediately after the general election, we've got 5 years or 4 years to go, government's just formed. Other kinds of things aren't very important at that point. This is the peak of the coalition's power. And that's why they did things like do their really difficult austerity thing at the point where they were most powerful. But then later on, I think, very good question, and I hadn't set you up to ask it, we begin to think about, well, how are the parties doing now? You know, what does that mean? We're not just looking at the past resource score, we want to add new things into the resource. So if we took today's average of the poll rankings, the Conservatives are at 31, Labour's at 42, Liberal Democrats are at 10, we projected that to the next Parliament, so it was an instant general election, Labour would have a convincing majority. So we might say that's going to be another factor that we'd added. So we'd have resources as it was in 2010, and then resources as it looks now. And then the other thing we typically do is we think, well, you know, let's allow for things that happen over time. So the Economist produced this graph, which is a graph of how leaders of opposition, of the opposition in the UK, have performed over time, starting from the day they're appointed, and you know, going forward with the months since they were elected as leader. And we can see Tony Blair, for example, is up here, highly successful leader of the opposition, net satisfaction score in the positive dimension, all the way along. We can see David Cameron was not very good for a long time, but then after about 2 years, he crept into the positive and he stayed there, and so forth. And we can see, like, Michael Foote, who really climb the depths down here, and all the failed Tory leaders like William Hague, Michael Howard, Ian Duncan Smith, you probably don't even remember him, if he ever was a Tory leader, and so on. So they are pretty negative. Neil Kinnock never got into the positives. And here we have Ed Miliband. So he went down a lot, he didn't look very good, and now he looks as if he might be edging back to the positive. So we can update and we can sophisticate the concept of resources. So we can think about what the party had in 2010, what it has now, how it's doing against the historical record, and so on. And that's, I think, how we essentially assess power. We think about what are relevant resources, and we add new things into the regression point. So that's my numbers thing. Enough of numbers. I want to just pick one last little thing to talk about, which is the United 93 case. United 93 was one of four planes hijacked on the 9th of September 2001 by Al-Qaeda hijackers. There were four groups of them. They each had four or five people. And they all operated on the same basis, which was to violently assault passengers and kill them, some passengers, and then get into the cockpit, kill the pilots, take over the plane, and fly the planes towards their targets and crash them with all the passengers on board. And in three cases, the whole scenario that they had set up operated exactly as the hijackers had anticipated. Actually, if you think about it, it's quite a tricky thing that they were trying to do, because there were only, on the United 93, there were four hijackers, One of them had to fly the plane. One of them was in the cockpit with the pilot. That left two people in the back of the plane. And they're not heavily armed. They had small kind of parcel opening kind of knives, which they had used to kill the passenger in the one passenger in the view of all the other passengers, thereby inducing compliance. They pushed all the passengers to the back of the plane, but essentially there were still 40 people at the back of the plane and two people at the front of the plane. And what they wanted to do was to keep the passengers completely quiescent so that they could fly the plane into their target, which we don't know quite which it was. It was either the US Congress or it was the White House. So that's a very strong and unusual power situation. Very extreme. There's no common interest between the hijackers and the passengers and crew. For the hijackers, the only reason they're trying to keep the passengers and crew quiescent is to realise their plan, which entails their suicide and the killing of everybody else. Very strong power over situation is established. And actually, what the hijackers did to try and keep the passengers quiescent was two things. Firstly, they told them they had a bomb, and they had a fake bomb, which one of the hijackers had strapped onto them. So it was a fake because they couldn't get a real bomb through the security checks. But the passengers don't know that. Secondly, they told the passengers a complete lie, namely that if they sat down and kept quiet, they would return to the airport and everything would be okay. So what happened on United 93 is that the passengers had a piece of luck. I mean, it was very bad luck to be on that flight, but they had a piece of luck which allowed them to see through this and understand what was happening to them and do something about it. And the luck was that the plane had been delayed on takeoff, so that it hadn't taken off at the same time as the other planes. It was 40 minutes later. In fact, the authorities had actually sent the pilots of this plane an alert message 2 minutes before they let the hijackers into the cockpit. A very badly phrased and garbled message that didn't do the job it was supposed to do. So, actually, the plane had to fly back a lot further and take a lot longer getting back. And during this time, the passengers rang their relatives, many of the passengers rang their relatives. And the relatives updated them, because 3 minutes after the first plane hit one of the towers in the World Trade Center, CNN was broadcasting that result. It's a fantastic media response. The CNN account executive or chief treasurer or whatever it was just looking out the window and saw the plane hit. And they didn't wait for government permission, they didn't ask anybody, they just started broadcasting straight away with what had happened. So by the time the passengers rang their relatives were watching this on TV and had very, very good information. And progressively the passengers built up a picture of what was really happening. And then the second plane crashed and the plane hit the Pentagon. And at that point they realised that this wasn't a normal hijacking, there probably wasn't a bomb, that this was a suicide mission, and that if they didn't do something about it, they were in a very bad place anyway, but you know, they certainly wouldn't get to get home alive if they just sat quiet. And so they mobilized, and we don't know exactly what happened, but they managed to disrupt the hijacker's plane, and the plane crashed in a field in Pennsylvania. So what we have here is a situation where the United 93 hijackers had a power relationship established in the first minutes and seconds after they'd seized control of the plane. They had a power relationship over the passengers based on the threat of violence, based on the threat of a bomb, based on the promise of a landing. And the passengers basically, subverted that power relationship, got themselves organized, So although this was an extreme power over situation, you couldn't imagine a more extreme power over situation, it was also a story of a power to organisation by the passengers. Meanwhile, we could just mention that all of the federal authorities were almost completely ineffective. So although they had lots and lots of what you would normally count of as power resources, they had lots of assets. They had lots of air traffic control equipment, they had radar and so forth. They had fighter jets and defense capability and so on. None of that operated because they just didn't have enough information to activate their resources. And they were slow and they were poorly coordinated and they took a long time to realize what was happening. And incidentally, the systems for information to pass between the planes and the federal authorities all ran through the cockpit. The passengers tried desperately to let the federal authorities know, and they never ever got through, and their message never ever got through to the formal government things. So you could just pull a few quick lessons out of that. Power is not force, but there are some situations that are pure power over situations. And what the 9/11 case, I think, reminds us is a quote from Sigmund Freud in his book Civilization and Its Discontents in the 1930s. And he argued there, men are not gentle creatures who want to be loved and who at most can defend themselves if they are attacked. They are, on the contrary, creatures amongst whose instinctual endowments is to be reckoned a powerful share of aggressiveness. As a result, their neighbour is for them not only a potential helper or sexual object, but also someone who tempts them to satisfy their aggressiveness on them, to exploit their capacity for work without compensation, to use them without their consent, to seize their possessions, to humiliate them, to cause them pain, to torture them, and to kill them. So, I don't know really of a clearer case than the 1993 case, although that's the case. But at the same time, although it's a very strong power over the situation, this sub-story of the passengers getting themselves organised and piecing together information and creating knowledge of what's going on is a very strong power to situation. So some of the people in my course suggested to me during the last term that perhaps this power over power to thing is like, you know, the dispute in science about whether light is a wave or light is a particle. Perhaps it's both of these usually at once. Thirdly, we can see that power decays. It's costly to enforce. Power holders often have to use bluff or deception. Exogenous luck can condition power relationships. The reason why three of the planes crashed into their targets and United 93 didn't, part of that, not to detract from the passengers' achievement in understanding what was happening, but part of that was the extra time that they had compared to the other groups who sat quiet, even though the hijacker-passenger balance was the same on all the planes. Power resources chain off each other, so sometimes you can have what looks like a lot of resources, what by conventional count is a lot of resources, which is what the federal authorities had. But if you don't have that key thing that fuels the whole chain, many of those conventional resources in particular settings will not work. So the passengers' great achievement was to organise and understand the narrative that they were involved with, while the federal authorities were hopelessly disorganised by comparison and didn't do the few things that they should have done, you know, pretty well immediately, which was to ground all the flights. So what these two stories, I hope, the sort of quanti one where we've got nicely measured votes and we can see what the decision threshold is and we can measure coalitional potential directly. What I hope these two stories show is that this is a general purpose solution. It doesn't take you very far because it doesn't tell you how to weigh resources and coalition potential. Maybe we have to redo that all the time for different situations, but I don't think it makes a huge amount of difference to
to the results. Exogenous luck can make more difference, and there's always an answer. So let me end with a quote from Nicholas Luhmann, where he said, if science produced a way of measuring power, it would alter social reality. It's rather a scary thought, because, of course, corporations and people would love to measure power. But we can console ourselves with the probability that social science will just develop its own index, which nobody else will take notice of, I hope. And that's the end. Thank you.
Do you want me to chair you? Okay. Questions? Right, so here you are, and then the gentleman at the back.
All the time you've been talking, I'm trying to apply this to what interests me, which is the power of the Prime Minister. And the Jones theory depends on a word called contingencies, or contingency, which never crops up in your discourse today. Didn't hear it. Your notion of resources, yes, I rely very, very heavily on that. But then I see resources like if you're playing a game of cards, they're the deck you're dealt. And the key thing there is that you have to have a skill to play. You've got to be able to play the game well. You may be dealt a bad hand, you may have few weak resources, but if you're a skilled player, you can really get what you want. Whereas you may have piles of super resources, but you're a hopeless player. So yes, resources alone are not enough. There's this capacity to play the game, which includes, I think, coalitional potential. I put your coalition potential under my capacity to play the game. And perhaps I put luck there too, because it involves, in this game-playing role, the capacity to take advantage of exogenous factors, the events, the sudden things that happen, the unanticipated things. And I think that error probably comes into my capacity to play the game as well. And then there's a third thing which you haven't mentioned, although I think it's the key that fuels my chain, political will. You've got to want to do something. You may have all these resources, you may be a skilled player, but if you don't want to do anything, or if you've got a very limited ambition, you won't do very much. So I've got three there that I think can include yours, but you didn't deal with my notion that the power of a Prime Minister is in fact contingent.
Okay, so you've got an interesting setting here, because the person that you're focusing on, one particular person, and you're focusing on this person as a person and not the head of a team or a block.
The Jones theory, if you recall from the little book, is that the premiership isn't one person.
Okay.
It's the team.
All right, so we've got a premier's block.
Yeah.
In a, usually a single party setting, and there are other blocks. So what we would say is, you know, the first and most basic distribution of resources is what the votes are like as between the different blocks. But there are other resources, quite minor ones, of which the skill of the Prime Minister, political will and so forth, I would enter down as resources. They add to the, you know, sometimes a Prime Minister has a kind of a strong political will and wants to do something. In some situations that's a positive resource, in some other situations it's a negative resource. But it's a resource. Similarly, the amount of political will I think is a resource. So I would say we would look to see, you know, capacity to play the game is a resource. It doesn't affect the basic size of the blocks and the basic importance of coalitional potential, which is given by the size of the blocks. You can be like, you know, I'm trying to think of the right person. John Major, you know, he certainly wanted to do various things. He was a moderately skilled person. He was in an absolutely very hard to sort out kind of block situation, which he couldn't get out of. I think it's very well expanded in Françoise's book on factional conflict, and I think factional conflict is the key resource. Capacity to play the game is the embellishment and detail. That's what I would suggest.
Okay, well,
a
gentleman in the back first.
Thanks very much. I really enjoyed your talk, and I wondered if you could tell us more about you and what the implications would be of having high and low U's, and whether whether you would consider taking U out altogether so that power could be resources plus coalitions without having to be what I view it as, which is resources moderated and mediated by coalitions. If you were to take, would you consider doing that, and what would be the implications of taking you out altogether?
Well, to some extent, it's a menu here. You can blend it to taste. If you're, you know, if you think resources are very important and very determinant, then you're going to rate U as very close to one. If you take, for example, many elite theory or Marxist accounts, they essentially say the conjunctural features are irrelevant. Leadership is irrelevant. You know, the only thing that's really important is the basic setup of the production relations or the distribution of resources. Similarly, if you look at the kind of liberal people who have developed and still advocate the power index literature, they say essentially that only C matters. U is trivial, and only C matters. Now, I think the great virtue and strength of trying to have this little formula and trying to focus down on what we don't know, and what we don't know particularly is the value of U, and therefore we don't know the value of 1 minus U, is exactly that it gets us to think about, well, how big would it be? I mean, so whichever position you're taking, you have to sort of tell me why you think, in this particular context, U is very important, or it's not very important. One of the things that the sort of numerical examples demonstrate, here, let's look at them all together, is that this column says, you know, U is one. And this column says U is zero. So that gives you an idea of what the range of variance is between the two possible extreme positions. And very often in science, when we don't know what the value of something is, it's very helpful to think about what the extreme positions are. And then we can think about, well, why don't we like this? Why do we not think it's true that, for example, you're as well off having 90% of the resources as you are having 52%. You know, the size of the winning majority never counts for anything. This is what the liberal theorists have to say if they take this position. Whereas, you know, this gives you some sort of indexing. If you don't like that indexing, change the value of U and prove to me why, you know. So I just picked, let's rate them equally, resources and coalitional potential. That's just a sort of start position. If you want to push it up, but how much are you going to push it up? You're never usually going to push it very far, and it's not going to make a huge amount of difference to the weighted average at the end. So a lot of people have like artificial disputes where they've overpolarized positions and they haven't really thought what would be the consequences of you know, you'd have to be in a very extreme position to either argue that resources were all important or coalitional potential was all important. And in many, many, these are very extreme differences I've picked here. In many cases, the difference between the ratings is much more convergent. It is very important, the difference between the two. But it's not, you know, for most situations, for most actors in most settings, resources and coalitional potential are quite close together. So I think there's less between these positions than you might think. And I think partly, the great value of resources is that resources condense a history and they also delimit a future. So your present resources usually are built up over time. Sometimes as somebody like Grillo comes along and he gets 25% of the vote from nowhere. But then perhaps we think he might get 0% of the vote tomorrow as well because he got 25% from nowhere. Do you see what I mean? Whereas if we have a whole history, you know, that brings us to this point, that's your current resources, that also indicates a range of possibilities for your future resources. So I think we are making progress here, even if it's rather modest progress.
Yes, thank you, Patrick. So what is the value of R to begin with in the calculation? Is that based on the support?
Well, R is a summary of the various resources that are relevant. So in some settings, like the legislative setting, the most key resource immediately after a general election might be just how many MPs you've got. But then later on, your opinion polls, the performance of a leader, other things might filter into the picture. So we might expand this so it becomes like a conventional regression equation with lots of different components or sub-components of R. Similarly, we might do that for Georgia's prime minister. You know, we might have the basic block sense, and then you might add some extra resources and skill.
Right. Two more things. So what's the difference between number 4 and 5? I'm not sure there is really that much difference. The luck and the information, case that you use, having, you know, mobile phones at your fingertips for the passengers, and that was really lucky, you know, it happened 20 years before, they wouldn't have been able to communicate with their relatives. They would have been very unlucky. So that's just that example. I'm not sure whether luck can be identify and on its own and quantify, I guess, if that's the ultimate objective.
Okay, so
it is sort of related to what George was saying in terms of contingency, isn't it? Luck to me is, could be unluck, you know, lack of luck. It's what you do at a particular time under certain contingencies.
And in your reply to me, you put that under the heading of resource. Indeed, everything was resources to you. You stretched it.
Okay.
To cover what I call the skill of playing a game. And you even included political will as a resource.
Sure.
Everything is a resource.
Because you didn't get this political will, you know, sprayed on you by a helicopter this morning, did you? You got it from a history. Resources come from history. Luck is something that's, you know, exogenous. So if we think about, if there'd been 4 hijackers at the front of the plane and some people from another society with very few mobile phones and no CNN, or even if it had just happened in Britain and the BBC had rung the government and they said, hang on, we don't know what's happening, don't say anything for half an hour, which is probably what would have happened, then, you know, the passengers would have been in a different situation. So because they were American passengers in America with the whole society, that's part and parcel of their resources. They had the intelligence, the education, the whole set of, that's part of their resource set. If it hadn't been activated by CNN, you're right, that resource set wouldn't have done them any good at all.
So it's the power to activate what you have.
Yes, but all of those things are part and parcel of their resources. So we have 4 pretty, you know, not terribly not American kind of people at the front, we have 40 American people at the back, or 40 people who are used to living in America and knew something about the capabilities. If the hijackers, I mean, some sources suggest that hijackers encourage people to find the harm, but if they really understood what their situation was, and they wouldn't have done that. But the thing about, you know, none of this would have mattered. That happened on all the other planes. Passengers phoned home. There's one very, very heartbreaking transcript of a person who rang Verizon, the main US operator, and talked to their supervisor for the best part of 20 minutes as the plane was approaching the towers. And the supervisor had tried endlessly to get the police or the FBI or anybody to, you know, connect with this person, none of which had ever happened. So the supervisor just stayed on the line to talk to this guy. So that was going on all over the place. But the difference was that this plane, the passengers had more time. So the exogenous thing, the completely exogenous to the situation and not related to the resources of the passengers, was the delay to the plane. But we have to be very parsimonious in designing what's luck. We mustn't enlarge luck to be resources.
Okay, the third question, and Martin.
The point was coalition potential is also not just the power to make a coalition, but the power to break a coalition. And often that's how you exercise it, your pivotal power if you're no longer a coalition. By withdrawing your power, you break the coalition. So, you know, I mean, that's still within the realm of your.
Yeah.
The
so
potential,
that's a very good point.
Power to
it's a blackmail. Blackmail is definitely
a
marginal blackmail.
Never quantified it, but that was really after this input into this blackmail potential, which is the reverse side of.
One of the things about coalitional potential is that it very much depends on how many actors are present.
Yeah.
Now, if you decide to leave the coalition, you've enlarged the number of actors present, and you've changed the distribution of resources. We have to recalculate coalitional potential as soon as you do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's an extra order of complexity, the dynamics of situations. As long as the dynamic is well behaved, so in this, for example, in the 1993 case, some people started advocating action and querying the hijacker's story and building up an alternative, and then they gradually got bigger and bigger. And usually, you know, most political conflicts it's about the aggregation of blocks to create a critical mass to do something. Breaking up blocks, you know, and blocks falling apart is an extra order of thing, but we would have to redo the coalition potential. The formula would still work, but it wouldn't be any good to you in predicting when it would work necessarily.
Not.
Is there a difference between theoretical power and effective power that should be included? And it might be that these come within the bigger picture issues, such as whether it be resources. Isn't it quite a dynamic and constantly changing equation, given some things, to think about George's example with prime ministers, look at, from relatively recent times, Major Blair, Brown, difference between small majority turning into minority, whopping great majority under a charismatic leader, and Gordon Brown, and how the dynamics within all of those things would have changed. Say, for example, Gordon Brown was going to lose. So, how did that affect his power? His
power went down.
Sorry,
his power went down because his resources were going down. Because one of his resources were his poll ratings. Another of his resources was the time he had between whenever we were making the assessment and the general election. As the time shrank and the poll ratings continued poor. So the Labour government became powerless, which is another interesting thing. You know, coalitional potential was the same as it was before. They still had a majority. They just didn't do anything with it. Particularly the last 6 or 7 months in office, they did nothing at all, except try and manage the crisis. They had no political project or anything. So there was a change in his resources, and his government's resources were declining. You know, resources do sometimes decline. You run out of time to do things. That's an ineluctable decay in your resources. The British government loses 0.1% popularity with every month that they're in office. It's an ineluctable rule. The longer you're in office, the more people blame you for everything that's going wrong, and get fed up with looking at you, and think about having somebody else to look at on TV next night. So you go down, it doesn't sound like much, 0.1%, but it means you lose 1.2% every year, and 5 years you've lost, you know, 7%, 6%. And in opinion poll terms, that's a lot.
It all comes down to resources, you'd say.
Yeah, resources are very dynamic. Resources are built up in the past, they're there at the present, and they also indicate where you're going to be in the future. It's very unusual for a party with 98% of MPs, or 98% of the vote, to not be the majority government after the next election. It's pretty plausible for a party with 52%, so that they might slip below the threshold. So, you know, you always need to think about resources as very changing, and they change in response to some factors, you know, that are ineluctable. You have a position as Prime Minister. It's very valuable at 5 years out from the general election. It's not very valuable 6 months out from the general election if your opinion poll rating suggests you won't be Prime Minister. If your opinion poll rating suggests you're going to win, you're still cruising on. So you've had a change in the resource mix.
So to some extent, resources is the ability to overcome an obstacle. Say, for example, take off the top of my head, say, a civil service reform. They could, the body that you're trying to coerce could put up blockades, drown you in bureaucracy, red tape, with the fixed end point for, and think we'll have a change of government, we can hang on until then, and then change the dynamic when that new government comes in. That would, you'd say, would come under resources.
Absolutely, yeah. Relative resources of you versus the blockers. Mm.
Right, there's a question, second or third.
So I definitely see the value in trying to identify the power and what you're onto, and trying to combine the two, the coalitional power versus the resource power. But it seems like in all of the examples that, like, I understand why you would want to know when you is zero and why you would want to know when you is one. But to know the nuance of the in-between, I can't figure out why you would want to quantify that in the first place. Because if you know it's always going to be in-between those, and you know what one is and you know what the other one is, then what's the purpose just generally of knowing what someone's power is? If it's mostly dependent on resources, and when resources change, then power changes. So it seems like they're almost the same. When you have the chart of all the different, all three of them laid out, there wasn't that much difference between what the power was versus what the resources were, to the point where I feel like we care as a society or as a person. What does it add?
Well, I mean, you're raising a really good question. I mean, you know, the denial of resources has been a classical liberal pluralist thing, where you insist that it all depends on the conjuncture, the setup, and the relationship, and maybe what you want to achieve, the kinds of things that George has mentioned. So, you know, if the Marxist belief theorists are right, power of resources is pretty okay. If, on the other hand, pluralists are right, and particularly the power index people who say, well, sometimes we do have situations like, for example, the Liberal Democrats had 57 MPs. They were as powerful as the Labour Party with five times as many MPs, just because the arithmetic of the situation was the way it was. If the Labour Party had managed to hang on to, you know, a few more seats, or the Liberals have had a few more MPs, then a Labour-Liberal coalition government would have been feasible. But actually, the way the arithmetic played out, it wasn't feasible. You couldn't form a two-party Lib-Lab government. You would have to create a very complex coalition, bringing lots of people, and even bringing in Scottish nationalists, Welsh nationalists, Northern Irish people. So, you know, that's a fundamental feature of the situation, which is still ongoing to this day, and underpins the whole survival and maintenance of the coalition. If the Liberal Democrats were to leave now, right this minute, or if David Cameron was to resign for some reason, or if David Cameron was to resign at any point early and call just resign as Prime Minister, he wouldn't necessarily be able to stop somebody else, like Ed Miliband, becoming Prime Minister. But he could resign, and bring an end to the coalition. But why don't we do that? Because then the only solution is either we have an instant general election, which for the Liberal Democrats is a very bad idea at the moment, and likely to remain so for the foreseeable future. Or we have a minority government. Voters don't like minority governments. They can't pass legislation. It's not really a good idea to induce that. So that's that little piece of arithmetic, which could have easily turned out differently in 2010. Another 10 or 15 seats either way could easily have produced a different piece of arithmetic. But that piece of arithmetic is very fundamental. And it plays out until we get to another general election. We can't change it. And that's why coalition potential is worth getting extra weight to, extra value to, looking at it very explicitly. Always accepting that, gradually your current opinion poll rating, for example, displaces your 2010 number of MPs or MPship. But that phasing in is very predictable. We know how that's happened in the past. We know how long it is to the general election, particularly nowadays because we've got a law that says it should be 5 years, and so on. So it's not like a random fluctuation of resources, and it's not like the coalitional potential is a small scale, thing. In many situations, it's fixed for a very long period of time, and it's very fundamental in its effect.
Yeah, I think that's the main problem with the power indices as a positive tools of analysis, the fact that there are strong non-linearities in the way the relation between power and resources, right? So that's why you can't really sort of directly derive, let's say, partisan incentive to accumulate sort of these types of resources over time, because that very much depends on what the electoral rule is or how much power or how many resources other parties have. So you have to look at the whole configuration, which is basically this very high sort of volatile type of analysis. So that's why it's mostly, I think, much more appropriate for the moment type of analysis, which is that's why we use it a lot for the European Council when we try to measure sort of a priori kind of
It's more of a comment than a question. Was there anything I could say that would... I don't think that, what I'm claiming, just to sort of emphasize its immodesty, is that this solution to the power problem works everywhere, in all places, and all times. We just need to get the listing of resources right, and we need to know what U is. That's basically why. Right.
Can you go back to your... And then anybody else, I'm going to ask a question from the chair. Can you go back to the first of the numbers?
This one? Yeah.
Yeah. Now, just let me... given that this was... If you look at this in the real world of the last British general election, then tell me why I'm wrong when I argue this. Had the I see how mathematically the coalitional potential comes out at 33.3, 33.3, 33.3, but had the Conservatives and Labour achieved a sort of dead heat in seats and votes, but still the Lib Dems were in the position where they had the blackmail come ration, really, the sort of pivotal position,
yeah.
then actually there's a resource implication of where the Labour Party had come from and where the Conservative Party had come from, isn't there? Which would mean it's not really 33-33-33. You see what I'm saying? That is, because it's not, 33 is an overstatement of Labour's position, an understatement of the other two positions, because effectively Labour was seen as having lost, it wasn't really a third. Their position yeah. was weaker than the maths would suggest.
Yeah,
momentum.
It is, well, it is a third, doesn't it? It is a momentum, is it? Yeah,
but actually, you know, if you look at the...
between resources and conditionality, isn't that a bridge between the two?
Yeah. Well, yes, but sometimes, in a very spooky way, coalitional potential embodies that. And in this particular case, it does embody that, because you can see that actually if we look at the empirical, you know, there's a particular way in which we calculate coalitional potential here. But it says Liberal Democrats and Labour had exactly the same coalitional potential. And the reason is that this is a very mindless kind of calculation. So it says the only people who could, nobody could form a two-party coalition except, you know, had to include the Conservatives. The Conservatives could form it with Labour or they could form it with a Liberal Democrat. Because it's a mindless low information index, it doesn't know that the last thing in the world that the Conservatives would do is form a coalition with Labour.
Well, that's the point. Well, I'm not saying that's the one where it's released, actually. It's the fact that there's a kind of resource implication of the feeding into the conditionality, because it though mathematically it's 33.3, it isn't in actual... If you're trying to measure power, it needs to be weighted.
Well, mathematically, it's 37, 22, 22. So since we've got the real numbers, let's stick with the real numbers.
No, but it didn't come out as... Because of the... If you go back to the slide with the you know, the chances of, you know, Labour and the Conservatives, Labour and the Lib Dems and Labour, it was always as likely as each other to get into bed, effectively. But that wasn't really true, was it?
I think what I would say is there were various other resources involved in the formation of the coalition. So, for example, Nick Clegg was probably the most right-wing Liberal Democrat leader that you could find, really, apart from Danny Alexander and David Laws. And he, you know, really hated Gordon Brown and didn't get on with him. So there were lots of other things in the way, and in addition to Gordon Brown having lost the election and so forth. So those were all part and parcel of the resource mix. I'd say. But what's important is the fundamental coalition of potential. If there could have been a Lib-Lab coalition, arguably we would have had a much more three-way, even division of the coalition of power. And many of these other parties would have become, they are assigned a weight, in a power weight, which actually they, a coalition weight, they never got to implement for various
Well, I'll just throw in that there could have been a Labour minority government to which the Lib Dems would later have joined if Gordon Brown hadn't been rushed by Peter Mandelson to give up because he didn't want to leave number 10 in the dark. He wanted to be in daylight. So, really, Labour gave up. The Prime Minister gave up when he could have tried a minority government. And who knows? Would all the others have ganged up against him in a vote of no confidence?
Yes. I think that's very, very unlikely scenario, but it's a possible scenario.
Somebody might have been ill, somebody, you know, on the death. Who knows what might have happened? But he gave up. He needn't have gone so soon, but for Peter Mandelson saying, get out, you don't want to go out in the dark.
I think there were a lot more structural reasons. After all, he had lost a lot of vote share. He had racked up the lowest Labour vote share. He was widely blamed, rightly or wrongly, for the economic crisis. It was a no-win situation for him. I don't think. One of the implications of this approach is that little things like who said what to whom very rarely matter in the long run or in the bigger picture. They sometimes do if they affect coalitional potential, but if they don't affect coalitional potential, they're just, you know, a little froth on the stream of the party politic.
Yeah, sorry, just a minor question or perhaps an observation. But when we talk about resources, that might comprise of individuals who are seeking to maximise their own power. So, for example, where we have a coalition, we may have a group of MPs who wish to maximise their own power. So, on a large scale, how do we take that into account in terms of how flaky, for lack of a best word, are the resources?
Okay, so one of the things about, you know, power, and especially the assessment of coalitional potential, right, is that it depends a great deal on how many actors you've really got in the situation. So supposing we have something called the Conservative Party, we've got to, for the purposes of, you know, coalitional potential calculations, we've got to assume that they're going to operate in a unitary way. As and when they cease to operate in a unitary way, and then we have maybe a right block and a modernising block, or a Eurosceptic block and a let's not rock the boat block, or whatever we say, then the number of actors shifts, and we have to redo all the calculations. So, for example, Françoise's very interesting book on faction politics and dominant party system shows that this is a very key influence on the performance of these parties over time. So, you know, whenever we shift the focus, power is always in relation to a specific issue, in relation to a specific context. The pluralists are absolutely always right about that, whereas sometimes Marxists and elitists have tended to use the importance of resources as, you know, as implying that if you're powerful in this domain, you're also equally powerful in lots of other domains as well. But we always have to redo the calculation. We have to redo the whole equation for each particular context. So we might have a party, you know, Conservative versus Labour versus Liberal Democrat, parliamentary overall legislative picture. And then we might have an intra-party picture which has got different sets of actors. I'm sorry if that, it's not, there isn't any overall power judgment that you can make outside of a particular context.
So in that case, does that mean that resources themselves are relative, dependent on the context that they're involved in? For example, you can't say that having X amount of material wealth is always beneficial.
Absolutely, that's true. And, you know, if you look at the very good film made by Paul, what's his name, about United 93. You know, one of the great contrasts in that film is between the passengers who are in a very bad situation and have, you know, very tense, very fraught, very, very few resources. But they actually manage to construct a good narrative of what's happening to them and to do something about it. Meanwhile, the sort of dialectic in the film is constantly showing the chaotic lack of organisation at the governmental and federal level amongst people who are sitting, you know, in the middle of banks of computers and massive amounts of personnel and technology and other things, none of which is any use at all because you can't activate it because they haven't got the key. Well, they could have activated, you know, they could have made certain decisions. They could have decided to ground the planes, all the planes, in the eastern USA as soon as they heard of two hijackings. That's what I would have done if I'd been a perfect decision maker. Yeah? But they didn't. They hang on. And even when they communicated with United 93, they sent the most obscure message that the pilots registered and received, and then 2 minutes later opened the door and let the hijackers in who killed them. So, you know, it is, you know, resources are very, very, the assessment of resources is the key thing. What you can't do is assume that you have blanket resources that work in every context. So, for example, in the overall framework of the coalition government, the right wing of the Tory party is powerless. There's nothing they can do on their own. And, you know, David Cameron is very powerful because he's sitting in the middle, he's the kind of median voter. But then if we just shift into inside the Tory party itself, we take the Liberal Democrats out of it, the right wing is very powerful. So you can have different rankings depending on the exact specification of the situation. To that extent, the pluralist critique of Marxism and elite theory is correct. But what's wrong is that it's still resources that count within each context and coalition potential.
Let me throw a final
pebble. Well, I was going to say, I've no idea whether that clock's right, so let's assume
it is.
Yeah. That's amazing. Right. One question quickly, George. Yeah.
You've left out one important player in this game, God, Sir Gus O'Donnell, who was here, who was put in the role as Cabinet Secretary of somehow creating this anti-Labour coalition, rushing them to form it before the markets, etc., which was all a lot of nonsense, there was no need. Indeed, he should have been serving as Cabinet Secretary, the Prime Minister and Cabinet, doing his best to go through all those other parties, making what would they come in and want, so that when eventually, and you didn't have to have the vote of confidence immediately, because government has to be carried on, you don't need Parliament all the time, there was sufficient time for Brown to have put together a coalition. Or else to have done the fixes, arms round the shoulders and all that, and promises, that would have enabled a minority Labour government to continue.
Well,
so he's let down, not only by Peter Madison, but also by Sir Gus.
I think that scenario, you know, sometimes might have worked if the arithmetic had been a little bit different. So if you think about how Julia Gillard survived, you know, in Australia, that's exactly how she survived. She only needed two or three more votes, and she did the kind of the things that you just recommended. But, you know, Labour wasn't in that situation. It needed to have the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish Nationalists, the Welsh Nationalists, and the Social Democratic and Labour Party all in a coalition, and to hold it together, and to persuade the Liberal Democrats that that was as plausible as a con-land coalition. There was no way on God's earth that they could have done that. Ergo, the, you know, Gus O'Donnell thing was irrelevant.
You wouldn't have had to have been as members of the coalition. You could have done fixes so that...
You'd have been living on your nerves every night of the week. And remember, how did James Cameron lose office? Because...
He was foolish enough not to bring...
He was depending on the Scottish and Welsh nationalists.
They broke his heart and he died because of what he did.
But this is a good example of why we could argue about what resources are relevant at a particular point.
Just to finish, a very quick theory, Patrick. If you could get the U, all the weightings and everything in the formula right,
yeah,
got it to work, so it then worked, theoretically it worked in the real world, actually you could measure power.
Yeah.
Would it measure it in a way that could be used, or would it only measure it on an individual, would every circumstance just be a snapshot of that power dynamic there, or would it have utility for the seeker of power?
I'm afraid it would be terribly, terribly usable. Because
right.
you would
That's
be able to, you'd be able to read off power, and then you'd be able to build a whole history, and you'd be able to model it, and then you'd be able to pay some consultant to get you it.
And that was what your Sutter Venture remark at the end was about.
That's exactly what I'm most worried about.
So you're researching this in order to prove it can't work, in order that we can be saved from it, are you?
No, I think
or find out it does work, and then keep it secret.
Well. I think we've just got to progress knowledge and live with the consequences. There'll be a countervailing response.
Very good. All right, wonderful way to end. Thanks, Patrick.